This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. A new 10-year study of the children of immigrants in New York City finds that most have successfully assimilated into mainstream America. Called Inheriting the City, the study focuses on young men and women in their 20s, the current second generation. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
There is a belief that lurks underneath all the current debates over immigration, that unlike the Europeans before them, the current wave of immigrants is not assimilating into the mainstream. But John Mollenkopf, a professor at the City University of New York, says if you look at the current second generation, that is, young people in their 20s whose parents were immigrants,
we found that that was definitely not the case. The kids are doing well vis-a-vis their parents, and they're also doing well vis-a-vis the native-born comparison group.
The study, funded by the Russell Sage Foundation, looked at five different groups: Russians, Dominicans, South Americans, Chinese, and West Indians. And it found that these groups were fluent in English, working in the mainstream economy, and were generally doing better economically than U.S.-born Puerto Ricans and African Americans. Because this is New York City and these are the children of parents who came 20 to 30 years ago, we're talking about immigrants who found it relatively easy to become legal, even if they didn't arrive as legal immigrants. Mary Waters of Harvard University says when you look at these five groups,
what we really find is a very rapid assimilation and becoming American.
They also uncovered fascinating cultural differences that they say gives the children of immigrants certain advantages, some groups more than others. Take schooling. It's not a surprise, it's even a stereotype, that immigrant parents push their kids to achieve. I sat around with six young people, all in their 20s, all from immigrant families and all alumni of elite New York City public high schools. Enya Titova and Leo Borofsky came from Russia when they were 12 and 10. They described what was expected from their families.
In a lot of Russian families, if you don't have a graduate degree, it's like frowned upon.
Even at this point, I still kind of hear a little bit of the, we came here for you, you know that.
When you get a 96, parents want to know where the other 4 points went. I mean, that's the question, I think, in a lot of immigrant households.
That kind of drive wasn't a surprise. What was unexpected was coming across cultural differences that led some groups to have much more savvy in working the system than others. Stuyvesant is one of the most competitive public high schools in New York City. Mary Waters says in the Chinese community, you might speak no English, but you still would know that. In fact, they found one out of five Chinese students went to magnet high schools.
We interviewed one young woman whose mother worked in a garment factory. She had very little education. She said her mother didn't even know what Stuyvesant was, but she knew from the other moms in the garment factory, I need to get my kid into this school. We interviewed some West Indian Dominican kids who had gotten into Stuyvesant, but whose parents wouldn't let them go because they would have to take a subway and go across bad neighborhoods to get there.
Ling Wukong, who came from China when he was two and is now in law school, says Waters is exactly right.
Every time there's a student who maxes out on the SAT, you know, their picture is prominently placed on the front page. In the Chinese newspapers, they give you a pretty good idea of what you should expect. So even for people whose parents don't speak English, they're able to navigate the system.
Christina Carpio is in medical school. Her parents came from Ecuador. She did go to Stuyvesant, but it took some convincing.
Growing up, my brother and sister were both like, if you get into that high school, that's it. You'll get into a good college and everything will be easier. Because from a young age, I wanted to be a doctor. But once I got into Stuyvesant, my mom was a little protective, like, oh no, she's a girl. She's going to be on the subway alone. What is that going to be like? And during orientation week, my sister took me to Stuy just to like kind of ease my mother's fears. Like, look, she knows how to take the subway. It's okay. She can do it on her own. And it's for her own good. She has to go to that school. There's no other way.
Here's something else they found that gives the children of immigrants in New York City big advantages. Many of them continue to live at home with their parents. Christina Carpio says when she becomes an intern next year,
I'll be moving back home because I can save the money on rent and pay for my loans.
I feel like it wouldn't be right if I didn't go home.
Ling Wukong.
There's this ideal of the what's called the 大家庭, which is when everybody lives together. I'm living at home now.
Phil Kazanitz, a professor of sociology at City University, brings home the economic point.
Black Americans, white Americans, Puerto Ricans seem to share the idea that you're supposed to leave home in your late teens or early 20s and that there's something really wrong with you if you're still living with your parents in your mid-20s. In that respect, the children of immigrants seem very much more in the immigrant model. They're much more likely to live at home longer. Now, In some housing markets, that might not be such a big deal. But in New York, that's a huge advantage in terms of being able to complete their education, being able to get their careers established.
The researchers conducted more than 3,000 in-depth interviews, and they also compared people in the five groups with U.S.-born whites, Puerto Ricans, and African Americans. When they looked at economic and educational achievement, they found that West Indians were doing better in general than African Americans. Dominicans were doing better than Puerto Ricans. The Chinese and Russians were doing as well or better than native-born whites. So inheriting the city paints an optimistic portrait of this second generation, but it has some warnings about the plight of U.S.-born minorities. It also notes that the children of undocumented immigrants have a tougher time assimilating, and the authors of the study wonder, since it's tougher to legally emigrate today, will the next second generation assimilate as easily? Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
Long a favorite of the Northeast, Dunkin' Donuts is moving west. The privately held company is expanding with the aggressiveness of, well, someone buzzed on caffeine and donuts, right into the territory dominated by one of its chief rivals, Seattle-based Starbucks. Dunkin' Donuts hopes the sour economy will provide a sweet spot for its brand, NPR's Ted Robbins reports.
The new Dunkin' Donuts on the corner of Stapley and Baseline in Mesa, Arizona, is not the place to go for a relaxing cup of coffee. Not this day. Not with dozens of people frantically wiping, mopping, and inspecting.
Windows are done. Floors are being done now. Drive-through.
Are we restocked?
It's the day before the store's grand opening. Out front, there's an enormous, well, drape over the front of the store, announcing that this is one of 9 new Dunkin' Donuts stores in the Phoenix area. All of them part of what the company calls an extreme makeover.
In the West, our brand was a little tired, a little run down, less relevant.
Max Schimmann is Dunkin' Donuts' vice president of emerging markets. In this case, emerging markets means the American West.
So you see a lot of bright colors here, a lot of yellows and pinks and oranges, which are part of our original theme.
Yeah, that's kind of 70s, isn't it?
It's actually kind of 50s. So we pulled it through from where we were founded in 1950 in Quincy, Massachusetts.
The new Dunkin' Donuts has more mood lighting, movable tables and chairs, and things on the menu besides coffee and donuts, like flatbread sandwiches.
For instance, this one on our menu here that you're looking on the left is our egg white breakfast flat. That's less than 300 calories. It's part of our Better For You menu.
Don't worry, the jelly donuts are still there. Think of the place as something between McDonald's and Starbucks.
I think they go after the consumer demographic known as the value seeker.
That's Darren Tristano. He's with Technomics, a food industry consulting firm.
And this would be anyone from lower through middle class that is looking for good value, which means a very good coffee for a good price.
With a weak economy, the company is counting on more people looking for value. They call them the Dunkin' Tribe.
There's tribe members that live in Phoenix that don't even know they're part of our tribe. They're going to find out when they get a chance to use us, and they're going to go, wow, this is a great thing for us. They'll associate with us.
In general, menu items here are about 20 to 30% cheaper than Starbucks, including coffee. Dunkin' Donuts makes about 60% of its revenue on coffee, and despite the updated surroundings in the new stores, food industry consultant Darren Tristano says Dunkin' Donuts' MO is more like McDonald's than Starbucks, which encourages customers to linger.
Dunkin' is much different. They're much more of a quick service model. They want you in and out. They're really trying to push people through the store.
Today we are going to be walking through all of the headsets, how to use the headsets, how to talk and communicate.
At the Mesa, Arizona store, a manager trains employees on serving customers quickly in the drive-through lane. The 9 new Phoenix stores are just a start. Dunkin' Donuts has plans for 150 in this area and 10,000 new stores in the next decade, starting in the Southwest, then moving towards Starbucks' home territory, the Northwest. Ted Robbins, NPR News, Tucson.
Andrew Jackson was a patriot and a traitor. He was the greatest of generals and wholly ignorant of the art of war. He was the most candid of men and capable of the profoundest dissimulation. He was a democratic autocrat. an urbane savage, an atrocious saint.
That was the description of Andrew Jackson by his first biographer, James Parton, in 1859. In his time, the seventh president of the United States and the father of the Democratic Party inspired hatred, pride, and reluctant admiration from his countrymen. It's a story that also inspired composer Christopher Hedge to write the music for a public television documentary about Jackson's life. The music is now available on CD. It's called Andrew Jackson, The Atrocious Saint. Christopher Hedge is in the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Leanne.
It's interesting to hear the very first cut, because the very first words that you write in the liner notes, and you use Andrew Jackson's description of himself, "I was born for the storm." I mean, is that first cut, you're setting us up to discover this man?
Yeah, very much. I think that there's a sense of his military foundation that was his original claim to fame. And then I think it begins to contrast sort of the panorama of characters that this guy represents and metaphors that he represents to me.
Hmm. Can you explain why Andrew Jackson was such a divisive figure in American history?
This is not a time where America was sure that it was going to survive. And I think that the elite in Washington were especially afraid of a charismatic military leader forming a populist leadership.
And meaning Andrew Jackson was not an elitist.
That's correct. He was of the people.
A populist, though, at the time, you know, you hear about what happened with the slaves and what happened with the Native Americans, and those don't sound like populist ideals to me.
I know. The quote from his first biographer, I think, and the reason that I titled the record The Atrocious Saint, is because of the contrasts and the real contradictions in Jackson and in his character. And I think those are contradictions that we have ourselves. We have an ideal of what we believe that we are as a country, and then you have the reality of what we actually do as people. And that's, I think, represented by Jackson.
There are no lyrics on the CD, but there are many voices here because you're telling the story of Andrew Jackson, not just his story, but the story of the lives he affected. The music of American Indians, R. Carlos Nakai, is the Native American flutist on a few tracks. Now, just a bit of background. Andrew Jackson served in the Army during the First Seminole War. Then as president, he oversaw the westward expansion and the Indian Removal Act. How are his policies toward Native Americans reflected in your music? You do have a tune called Trail of Tears.
Jackson, I think, believed that he was saving the Cherokee, but they did it in such a rushed way and such an unprepared way that it was a tremendous tragedy and thousands died. When R. Carlos is playing, it's his ancestry that is playing through the flute. He, I think, is the most appropriate person to be able to translate for the rest of us how that feels.
R. Carlos Nakai is teamed with Tito Sampa, the percussionist. Yes. He's from the Congo. Now, why pair these two?
The idea in this case was that the Indians were being removed and the slaves were being forced in. And there is, to this day, a huge tension between these two cultures. And to me, it seemed a worthwhile idea to put these two in the room together, and it was, I think, wonderful. ¶¶
You concentrate on the voices of slaves in Work Song. Andrew Jackson kept slaves himself. Slave labor was important to his westward expansion. What are we hearing in this song?
Titos is struggling through this piece, and you can hear his sort of pain as he contemplates the endless labor that people were subjected to with absolutely no potential for ever rising out of it.
Did Titos have a difficult time performing the song?
I think so. This is a source of great sadness to Titos. He tells a story of Louis Armstrong coming to the Congo. He came to Titos' town when Titos was just a boy. And as soon as Louis Armstrong looked over the crowd and recognized the curvature of the face and realized that this was his ancestral, this is his people, people looked like him, he said that he broke down in tears. And the whole crowd was so affected that they put him on a what they call a king carrier. They lifted him up and carried him across the river into Zaire. And that shows you how deep the root between those that were removed and those that are still there. And so Titos carries a lot of that with him.
You worked on this project for a long time, did a lot of research. Did you get any new understanding of that time?
I got a new understanding of our time. I found my way backwards through that time, and I was completely surprised and fascinated by how little I knew about it. That taught me a lot about how we are now, and I see this very narrow focus on the image of what an American is. A person looking at history has to look at all of the histories, and there are so many more than the narrow focus that we normally have. And that's why you have the music from the Irish and Scottish and Native American and slave and parlor music and classical. These are all the things that form this great collection of soul that we are.
Christopher Hedge is a composer based in San Francisco. His new CD is called Andrew Jackson, the Atrocious Saint. He joined us from member station KQED in San Francisco. Thank you.
Thank you, Leanne.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Our month-long series on race and politics continues now. In a moment, we'll hear from listeners who've been part of our web discussion. But first, this historical footnote about the genesis of the March on Washington, 45 years ago this week, made famous by Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children.
King's March was a long time in the making. On the eve of World War II, African Americans in the North had achieved some real political leverage, but in the South, poll taxes, literacy tests, and intimidation had almost completely disenfranchised them. A. Philip Randolph was the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, a black labor union. He and Union Vice President Milton Webster wanted to take action.
Brother Randolph said to me, "We ought to get 10,000 Negroes and march down Pennsylvania Avenue and protest."
That threat led to meetings with President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Randolph described the president's reaction.
He said, "We can't have 100,000 Negroes marching on Washington. You wouldn't be able to manage them. We might have bloodshed and death." I said, we want you to issue an executive order abolishing discrimination in munition jobs and also in the government.
The negotiations went on for months.
He said, I want you to call off this march first. I said, that, Mr. President, I can't do. The people would consider that I had betrayed them. He said, will you march against the President of the United States? I said, we have no other alternative.
Roosevelt agreed to set up the first Fair Employment Practices Committee, and Randolph agreed to call off the March on Washington. 7 years later, Randolph again threatened demonstrations, this time against drafting blacks into a segregated military. He met with President Harry Truman.
I told him that Negroes today were in no mood to shoulder a gun again to fight for democracy abroad until they got democracy at home.
Truman agreed to integrate the armed forces. Randolph called off the march again. But in 1963, when the civil rights movement was gaining momentum, it was finally on. And 45 years ago this week, Randolph marched with Martin Luther King Jr., who told 200,000 supporters that he had a dream. This historical footnote is adapted from independent producer Alan Lipke's Between Civil War and Civil Rights documentary series. You can find a link to it on our website, npr.org. Years ago this week, protesters clashed with police on the streets of Chicago during the 1968 Democratic National Convention. The violence marred the convention. It may have cost the Democrats the presidential election that year, and it badly damaged the image of Chicago and its mayor, Richard J. Daley. Now his son, Richard M. Daley, runs The City That Works, and he is closing in on his father's record for longevity in the mayor's office. As part of our occasional series, Echoes of 1968, NPR's David Shaper reports on how the power of the two Mayor Daleys has evolved over the past four decades.
By most accounts, Mayor Richard J. Daley and his police force handled the demonstrations during the 68 convention poorly, with the whole world watching, cops beat protesters. A later inquiry would call it a police riot. The tone was set by Daley himself, who at the time had the most powerful Democratic machine in the country.
He was the last of the big city bosses.
Chicago Alderman Ed Burke's career overlaps with both Daley's. He was first elected in 1969 as an ally of Richard J. Daley.
He had a great pride in Chicago. He had a great love for the city. And throw into that a good measure of his Irish temper, and you had a volatile mix.
In 1968, Burke was a Chicago police officer assigned to the convention. He was on the floor, just a few feet behind Mayor Daley, when Connecticut Senator Abraham Ribicoff altered his speech nominating George McGovern.
And with George McGovern as President of the United States, we wouldn't have to have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago. With George McGovern.
Daley defended himself and his police force with a little slip of the tongue.
The confrontation was not created by the police. The confrontation was created by the people who charged the police. Gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
The Democratic Convention of 1968 was a disaster for the city of Chicago. It was a disaster for Richard J. Daley, and it was a disaster for the Democratic Party.
Paul Green is director of the Institute for Politics at Roosevelt University in Chicago and has co-authored four books on the Daleys.
He was never the same.
Daley's influence nationally started to wane. Retired WBBM political editor Bob Crawford covered both Daleys.
The 68 convention left such a bad taste in the mouths of Democrats all across the country that even party regulars were blaming Richard J. Daley for the fate of the party losing the election in 68.
But at home, he was a hero. Richard J. Daley won re-election in landslides in 71 and 75, and he maintained firm control over Chicago City Council. He was still the boss until the day he died of a heart attack in 1976. But back to that scene on the floor of the convention hall in 1968. Look closely at the pictures of Daley screaming back at Ribicoff. And over the old man's shoulder is a young Richard M. Daley, screaming right alongside his father.
He saw chaos.
Again, Paul Green.
He saw chaos, and he saw his dad lose control.
And control is something a Daley never wants to lose. Retired WBBM political editor Bob Crawford.
I think he may have learned at that time that power is everything, and weakness is nothing.
But rather than try to control or influence everything, from local judges in the state legislature to Congress and the president, as his father had, the younger Daley began to adapt to a new era of politics in which the political parties were less important, the media more so, and in which voters are more diverse. Alderman Ed Burke.
He came to the conclusion very early on that he had to change with the times or that he was doomed to failure. And he made a very conscious effort to avoid the mistakes that older political bosses in Chicago had made.
The second Daley lost his first try to win his father's old office. His challenge to Mayor Jane Byrne in 1983 split the white vote, allowing for the election of Chicago's first black mayor, Harold Washington. Many elements of the old machine were falling apart, so Daley started building a new machine. After Washington died in 1987, Daley put together a coalition of the remaining white ethnic ward bosses, Latinos, and white lakefront liberals. He included gays, Asian Americans, and others to win the mayor's office in 1989. In every election since, he's added a growing number of African American supporters, in part by focusing on evenly delivering city services and by making sure a fair share of city jobs and contracts go to minorities. Marilyn Katz was one of the organizers of the 68 protests. Her political consulting firm now does a lot of work with the current Daley's administration, and she calls his more open and inclusive governing style radically different than his father's.
I think Daley learned the lesson that a number of things, that it is better to incorporate dissenting voices than to smash them, that power was probably more secure when shared.
The current mayor's critics suggest this Daley is only inclusive to the extent he has to be, and they say he can be just as controlling, autocratic, and vindictive as his old man. Former Alderman Dick Simpson now teaches political science at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
Chicago politics has transmogrified. It has put on a pretty new face, and it has globalized. But its heart is still an old politics.
A case in point is right here. I'm in Chicago's Millennium Park, a beautiful open space with an amphitheater, botanical gardens, sculpture, and fountains. It's built above railroad tracks that were once the eyesore of Chicago's lakefront. You see, both Daleys are builder mayors, focusing as much on the city skyline and big public works projects like this as delivering basic city services. And this park is a whopping success, the crown jewel of the city, but it cost hundreds of millions of dollars more than projected, and contracts went to key Daley supporters.
Call them great mayors, but remember the price.
And Bob Crawford says that price is corruption, which has been rampant in Chicago under both Daleys. Though neither has ever been charged with wrongdoing, Dick Simpson says both are somewhat responsible for it.
It's like gum on the bottom of the shoe. If you're going to wear the shoe of machine politics, you're going to have the gum of corruption.
The second Mayor Daley has introduced more reforms to open up government than his father, and his national image is different, too. This mayor is looked to by other mayors as a leader and innovator on issues ranging from schools and crime to the environment, but not so much to deliver votes.
This Mayor Daley isn't really as powerful as Richard J. Daley was.
Again, Bob Crawford.
Richard J. Daley had a true political machine which wasn't compromised by anything. Total loyalty from the first man to the last. We all know he was a kingmaker in presidential politics. He could pick up a phone and talk not to the president's secretary, but to the president himself. He had the president's private number, you know. Well, this Richard M. Daley can't do that because he doesn't rule on the basis of a true machine style of politics. He rules on the basis of a coalition.
Of course, that could change this fall if Chicago and Barack Obama wins the White House. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen, and joining us is Puzzle Master Will Shortz. Hey, Will.
Hey, Leanne. Welcome back.
Thanks very much. Had a great trip to Yellowstone. Wait till you hear the stories we have coming up in September. I'm still getting over the 45-minute backup behind a bison that just decided to wander on the road. What a place. Absolutely gorgeous. Well, I didn't get to hear the puzzle last week, so you're going to have to repeat that clue for me and obviously for everybody listening.
Yes, it came from listener Tom Denk of Ann Arbor, Michigan. I said, take the two-letter postal abbreviations for three U.S. states, add the letter A, then the two-letter postal abbreviations for three more U.S. states, 13 letters in all. Reading from left to right, you get a familiar three-word phrase that's seen on many products. What is the phrase?
And your answer?
Answer is Made in America. That is Massachusetts, Delaware, Indiana, Maine, Rhode Island, California, plus the letter A.
Cool. Well, you know, we had close to 3,000 correct entries for this particular challenge. And from those entries, our randomly chosen winner is Sharon Werner. And she joins us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Leanne.
So what do you do there in Baton Rouge?
I'm a family practitioner.
Ah, a doctor.
Yes.
Yeah. How long have you been playing the puzzle?
Well, actually, submitting an answer, this was my first time.
Really?
But I've been listening for about 8 years.
All right. Okay, that puts you in a category that the longtime listeners who have never been picked, they're not going to get too mad. How long did it take you to solve this one?
Actually, it was pretty quick. It just came to me. I just visualized it, and he gave the second part of the clue, which told how many letters were in each word, and it just fit.
Good for you. So, you know what you get to do now.
I know.
You ready?
I'm ready.
You don't sound nervous. You sound excited.
I'm excited.
All right. Well, Will, meet excited Sharon. Let's play.
All right, Sharon, I'm going to give you some words that contain CH somewhere inside. You anagram them to make new words that start with CH. For example, if I said inch, I-N-C-H, you would say chin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Number one is much, M-U-C-H.
Do you fish?
No.
I think I'll help you with this one then.
Okay.
Chum.
Chum, is it?
Could be.
As in a
buddy, right?
A pal or friend. Yeah. That's right. Here's number two, ochre, O-C-H-E-R.
Chore.
Chore is it. Good. Your next one is peach, P-E-A-C-H.
Cheap
is it. Aches, A-C-H-E-S.
Chase,
good. March, M-A-R-C-H.
Charm.
Uh-huh. Echoic, E-C-H-O-I-C.
Choice.
That's right. Ratchet, R-A-T-C-H-E-T.
Chatter,
good job. Arching, A-R-C-H-I-N-G.
Chairing?
No, it can't be a proper name.
C-H-A.
And I'll tell you, if you don't get this, it will be much to your...
Chagrin.
Yeah.
Chagrin, is it? All right, try this one. Snitcher, S-N-I-T-C-H-E-R.
S-N-I-T-C-H-E-R?
Right, someone who tattles as a snitcher.
Christen,
that's right.
Yeah.
Good, and here's your last one.
Okay.
Archaism, A-R-C-H-A-I-S-M. And I'll give you a hint, this is something you might look for in a political candidate.
Charisma,
nice job.
Nice work, Sharon.
Well, I got warmed up there.
Yeah, I would say you got hot there. Nice work. Well, speaking of charisma and politicians, it is the beginning of the Democratic National Convention. It begins tomorrow. So we asked one of Senator Barack Obama's biggest fans to read the prizes. You may have seen her on YouTube featured in the video for this song.
Mm. Hi, my name is Amberlee Ettinger, a.k.a. Obama Girl. For playing our puzzle today, you'll get a weekend edition lapel pin, the 11th edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary and Thesaurus, the Scrabble Deluxe Edition from Parker Brothers, the Puzzle Master Presents from Random House Volume 2, Will Shorts' Little Black Book of Sudoku, and Black and White Book of Crosswords from St. Martin's Press, and one of Will Shorts' Puzzle Master Decks of Riddles and Challenges from Chronicle Books.
Obama Girl. Sharon, I hope you enjoyed that.
I did. That was great.
It was fun, wasn't it?
It was. Thank you very much.
A pleasure. But first, before we let you go, tell us what member station you listen to.
WRKF 89.3 in Baton Rouge.
Go for it. Sharon Werner of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Thanks a lot. You were a great guest.
Thank you, too.
All right, Will, what's that challenge you have for us to work on for the next week?
Yes, it's a spinoff of my on-air puzzle. Name a person, as in a title or position, that contains the consecutive letter CH. Switch the CH with the first letter of the word, that is, move the CH to the front and move the first letter to where the CH was. The result will name another person whom the first person tries to catch. What words are these? So again, name a person, a title or position, that contains CH. Move the CH to the front and move the first letter to where the CH was. The result will name another person whom the first person tries to catch. What words are these?
When you have the answer, go to our website, npr.org/puzzle, and click on the Submit Your Answer link. Only one entry per person, please. Our deadline this week is Thursday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Please include a phone number where we can reach you at about that time. We'll call you if you're the winner, and you'll get to play Puzzle on the air with the puzzle editor of the New York Times and Weekend Edition's Puzzle Master, Will Shorts. Thanks a lot, Will.
Thanks, Leanne.